All right, welcome everybody. A pleasure to welcome Rabbi Dr. Ezra Fraser, who, as you heard, teaches Judaic studies at Heschel High School in New York, right at the border of the center of New York City, and also very interesting serves as a chaplain, a Jewish chaplain in the U.S. Air Force Reserve. He has taught at Yeshiva University and a number of high schools and involved in Chidon HaTanach, has a received his smicha at YU with a PhD in Bible, and also got smicha from the chief rabbinate in Israel, is living in Teaneck, as you may have heard, and we're pleased to welcome his mother, who also lives in Teaneck, and the Fraser family is sponsoring the shir tonight in memory of Ellie Tonkin. I think that's Ezra's aunt, Aliza Bat Moshe, the Isha Eliana. And may we be blessed with good health and long life, and this Shema should have an Aliyah, and we should have happy occasions to come together and celebrate. Okay, Vakasha Ezra, it's all yours.
Thank you, Rabbi Kelman. Pleasure to be here once again, my second time doing a shiur like this. Did everyone hear me okay? Okay, so the topic I want to talk about tonight is, there's so much in Parshat Shemot. It's a scene that it happens, and the moment it feels very exciting. Moshe is finally becoming his own person, standing up for this Jew who's being beaten by presumably an Egyptian taskmaster, and he rescues the Jew from the Egyptian. And then so many more things happen in the Parsha after that, that I know when I studied it when I was younger, I never really sort of thought for a moment, wait a minute, in that particular moment when Moshe encounters the Egyptian and Jew, and the Egyptian is beating the Jew, was killing the Egyptian really the most prudent and most moral course of action? And I first thought about it, often with things like this, there'll be a certain moment where you remember what was the trigger that got you to think about something differently. I was a student in Israel in Yeshivat Har Etzion, and we had in the yeshiva what we called the Daf Kesher, the sort of weekly parsha sheet that they would, it was meant to send to the students, the Israeli students who were serving the army to keep them connected, but we would read it in the yeshiva too, mostly for the announcements, right? Like the, Shul Devar Torah thing that also says the Mazel Tovs. We'd read it for that. I don't know how often people typically read the student Devar Torah, but the week of Parshat Shemot, the particular student Devar Torah was written by a student who was a bit of a sort of rabble-rousing type. He actually referred to Moshe as a cold-blooded murderer because of this scene. And then, the next week, Rav Yaakov Maidan, who at the time was one of the Rebbeim in Goshen, today is one of the heads of the yeshiva, wrote this very forceful response saying it's inappropriate to say that. But it went beyond that, sort of picking apart the actual substance of the argument that what Moshe did was murder, and instead justifying that using deadly force was the right thing to do in this case. And so the more I became interested in this, you see that, in fact, many of the Mefarshim have different perspectives. Most of them assume that Moshe did the right thing and disagree about why that is. And then there's this one somewhat more obscure source that I learned about from the Devar Torah by the student who called Moshe a cold-blooded murderer that actually is somewhat critical of him. So I want us to take a look at these sources. I'm going to share my screen so that, Rabbi Kelman already posted a link to the sources, but I think by sharing the screen, we'll all sort of be on the same place in the sources at the same time. And here we go. And I'm going to the top of this. And I think as we work through these sources, we're going to hopefully gain some deeper insight into exactly how the text itself, as it narrates the story, wants us to feel. Is the text of the Torah trying to give us the sense that Moshe got carried away and was too violent? Or on the contrary, does the text support what Moshe did? So we have this story over here that I'm going to read it in Hebrew, but you see the English right below it. And you see the word makeh over there. Moshe sees this Egyptian, striking or beating a Jew. This particular translation used beating. This particular translation is from the start of my teaching career 20 years ago. before some of the word processor programs we have now, people would use Dafka Writer, this word processor that was tailored for Judaic studies teachers. And this was the default translation. And often now, if I'm preparing a sheet, I might replace it with a translation that I'm more fond of for whatever reason. But I actually like the fact that you can see here visually with the English and Hebrew, the way I highlighted, how you see the word beating there, the Egyptian's beating in Hebrew. Then Moshe looks both ways. Vayach et Hamitzri in the Hebrew. Vayach is also from the word lahakot. But this time around, instead the translation says he slew the Egyptian, right? Slew, killed. A day later, Moshe goes out. He sees two Hebrews fighting. Vayomer la Rasha, lama taker re'echa. And then Moshe says to his fellow Hebrew, why are you, again, that same root, lahakot, here they translated as to strike. But notice the same word in Hebrew all three times. Makeh, vayach, hakeh. So Moshe sees an Egyptian beating a Hebrew. He slays the Egyptian. Then he tries to break up a fight in which one Hebrew is striking another. But the Torah uses the same word for all three, which I think is significant. We'll come back to that. This person did not appreciate Moshe's comment, and he says back, who made you in charge? Misamcha le'ish sarvish ofed aleinu? Hallo horgeni atamir, what, you're going to kill me? Kasher haragta tamitri, it just says you killed the Egyptian. At that point, Moshe gets nervous that people know what's going on. Paro hears about it. Pharaoh, he wants to slay Moshe. Again, the word laharog. So, and Moshe has to run away. You see from, you know, my color coding system, we basically have two Hebrew roots. One root that could mean, apparently, to beat, to slay, or to strike, any of those, lahakot. And then the second root, verb, you know, laharog, which means to kill or to slay, which is basically a synonym for to kill. Just reading the story, the text never explicitly says this was a good decision or a bad decision. So that's sort of for us to try and determine. One could imagine how someone might think that the let's go with this particular translation, beating someone is a crime, right? We call that, you know, assault and battery, something like that. It's not a capital crime, typically, right? So to use deadly force to prevent someone from beating up someone else could be seen as an overreaction. And Rabbi Yosef Bechor Shor, who was one of the Balei Tosfot, in Tosfot in the Talmud, he's referred to as Rabbi Yosef, looks like Me'or Linus, right? Me'or Lian, Joseph of Orlean, a student of Rashi's grandsons. He sort of puts words in the mouth of this Hebrew who's talking back to Moshe. This person says to Moshe, who made you in charge? Who made you the judge? Bechor Shor imagines the person saying, what? Are you going to kill me in ways that are against the law? Somebody beats up their friend, they don't deserve the death penalty for that because the aggressor wasn't trying to kill anybody, he was just trying to hurt someone. Right? My friend and I were in a fist fight, which is not a nice thing to do, but I don't deserve to die for that. And I mean, you, Moshe, that's something you're going to do. Kasher haraktet hamitzri, because you did that to the Egyptian, shelo kidin. When he did it to the Egyptian, Bechor Shor imagines this other Hebrew saying to Moshe, you did that, shelo kidin. It was illegal what you did. Shaya oset mitzvah hamelech l'tchok hayehudi. That taskmaster, right? First of all, you know, so what was said earlier in this comment to Bechor Shor, he wasn't necessarily trying to kill a Jew. He was only beating him. Moreover, it was totally legal under Egyptian law because he was a taskmaster beating a slave. And so who do you think you are, Moshe? This person was engaged in completely legal conduct and you killed him. Now, Bechor Shor is not saying that he thinks Moshe did the wrong thing. He's imagining, you know, if somebody were to talk back to Moshe, and we have a character in the story who is talking back to Moshe, they wouldn't just be saying, you know, we don't like what you're saying to us, but they could say in a more substantive way, what you're doing seemed illegal. So how do different Mefarshim respond to this? I'm actually going to unshare and reshare. I think if I open the document in Word, I'll be able to highlight text better rather than that PDF format. So I'm just going to reshare my screen. So like I alluded to, there is one school of thought, which claims that, in fact, Moshe did the wrong thing. This is a text known as Midrash Petirat Moshe, the Midrash of Moshe's death. We're not going to read the whole thing inside, but this is commenting on the last verses of the Torah when Moshe is about to pass away. And he's making one last-ditch effort, the way this Midrash imagines it, to beg God to not, to spare his life and to allow him to go into Eretz Yisrael. And again, in the way the Midrash pictures this, Moshe is saying, look, you are such a great, faithful servant of God. And God keeps saying back to him, are you better than this biblical hero who died? Are you better than that biblical hero who died? And Moshe keeps defending himself and saying, look, God, you said I'm your most faithful prophet. And finally, at a certain point, God is saying, look, nobody's perfect. People sin and people die. And Moshe is kind of saying, well, what did I ever do wrong? So God says to Moshe, you want to know what you did wrong? Did I ask you to kill that Egyptian? Why did you kill him? So Amar lo Moshe, Ata ragta kol b'charei Mitzrayim, v'ani amut mishum Mitzriya achad. Moshe says, wait a minute, God. You killed every firstborn in the whole country of Egypt. So that's what? Thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions. That was okay. I killed one Egyptian, and suddenly that one Egyptian life matters. If Egyptian lives are so important to you, why did you kill so many of them in the plague of the firstborn? Amar lo HaKadosh Baruch Hu, v'ata doma elai mimidu m'chaya. God says back to him, what? You know, there's a difference between us, right? I'm God. I'm Mimit Machaya. I take life and I give life. Do you give life? I have a right to take life because I also am the God who gives life. But you cannot give life. You have no business taking lives. And hence, Moshe ultimately loses this argument and Moshe died. So in the way this text envisions it, I agree with Rav Maidan, when I was in Yeshiva, who said it's an overstatement to say God is calling him a cold-blooded murderer. He's saying, look, you overstepped your boundaries a little bit when you killed this Egyptian. Maybe you meant well, but you have this blemish on your record from the fact that you did that, and that's why now you're going to die and you're not going to enter the land of Israel. Interestingly, this text, Petirat Moshe, you don't know a whole lot about it. It's often called Midrash Petirat Moshe. It's not from the time of the Tanaim or the Amoraim. It's from the Gaonic period. And so when this debate arose when I was a student in Yeshiva, Rav Maidan said, look, this is a text which, in his opinion, is a real outlier as far as criticizing Moshe for his conduct. It's of unknown authorship. And so how much credence should we really give it? I did notice a couple of years after that time in Yeshiva, when I taught Shmot for the first time, I've benefited a lot from reading Nechama Leibowitz's ready-made lessons. Her articles are really like perfectly crafted lessons that a teacher can use on Shmot. And she does quote the source. She doesn't, overly dramatize it and, vilify Moshe, but she does end her lesson on this topic with the source to say, look, it's possible that Moshe did somewhat overstep his bounds. I want to argue tonight, as we go through certain other sources, that I don't think that really is consistent with a simple reading of the actual narrative in Shmot on the Pshat level, on the simple level. And I want to look at why as we go through some other commentaries. So this next approach, which really is different sources that don't all say the same thing, I want to call it that approach that says kind of Moshe, apparently he's right. He must be right because he's Moshe. He must be right because on the Pshat level, God never tells him he did anything wrong. And these are texts that basically say he did the right thing. But the argument is that apparently if Moshe did it, it's the right thing. So the Talmud, the Gemara Masechet Sanhedrin, says, Amar Rabbi Chanina, Goy Shika Yisrael Chayev Mitah. If a non-Jew strikes a Jew, he deserves to die for that. Why? Well, it quotes our pasuk, because Moshe, the Gemara does this sometimes, it quotes half of the pasuk, but the proof is really from the second half. And it quotes that Moshe turned around and saw there was nobody around. That doesn't prove anything. The proof is that then Moshe killed the Egyptian. Now, had the Egyptian committed murder, even attempted murder? Apparently not, in the eyes of the Gemara. The Gemara, Rabbi Chanina, the Gemara is saying, all this person had done was beat a Jew, But Moshe killed him. Assumption. Apparently Moshe did the right thing. And so apparently you deserve to be killed for doing that. And so the Gemara here is very much defending Moshe. If you think about it, it doesn't give us any further proof or further source beyond the pasuk in which Moshe killed the Egyptian. There's no second source from elsewhere to prove that elsewhere God endorses this kind of behavior and therefore Moshe did the right thing. It's basically saying Moshe is our hero, Moshe is our role model, Moshe Rabbeinu. If he did it, apparently that must be what the Torah or what God would endorse. Rambam codifies this halacha, but it's interesting how he limits it just a little bit. Rambam, Maimonides, right, in his Code of Jewish Law, says, Goy Shekai Yisrael Chayav Mita, that's a direct quote from the Gemara. Shne'emar, he quotes the same pasuk. So he literally cuts and pastes the Gemara into his halachic code and the laws of Chovel HaMazik that deals with the laws, the damages, if you sort of injure someone, what types of damage payments you have to pay. He said, well, if a non-Jew is to, you know, beat a Jew, they can be killed based on the story of Moshe. But then, in Hilchot Malachim, the Rambam has a section where he has the halachot that apply to non-Jews, what we call the mitzvot b'nei Noach. And in that section, he gives the same ruling, Goy Shikai Yisrael afilu chaval bo, even if the non-Jew actually causes real damage to the Jew, af al pishu chayav mitah, even though the Talmud said, and Rambam already wrote elsewhere in his code, that that's a capital offense, theoretically, the Rambam says, Eino neherag. He's not actually executed, right? Theoretically, but not in reality. So, and I'm not going to delve into this in the interest of time. In this footnote, if anyone's interested, you can sort of read it on your own. But Rambam has a series, Rambam assembles together in Hilchot Malachim, where he's giving his sort of laws, what the Torah asks of non-Jews, a handful of rabbinic statements that say if a non-Jew does X, Y, or Z, they deserve to die for it. And a couple of them, right, if a non-Jew observes Shabbat, if a non-Jew studies Torah, it seems a little bit hard to really think that Talmud envisions that being something you get capital punishment for. The Rambam lumps all of them together, and he has this letter where someone asked him, why did you write in your code that a non-Jew cannot be executed for these things? The Talmud says they're capital offenses. And the Rambam says, well, I observed the distinction between cases where the Talmud will say neharag, one is killed, which sounds like an actual real-life capital offense you could be convicted of, versus times where the language of chayav mita is used, the person sort of hypothetically, theoretically deserves to die. Rambam interprets those as more of a rhetorical statement, but not an actual death sentence. That then begs the question, if Rambam is saying, look, the Talmud did say that a non-Jew strikes a Jew in theory is liable to die, but in practice we don't actually kill anyone for that, isn't that a problem? Because in our text over here, our proof is from Moshe. Moshe did not tell the Egyptian, in theory, you deserve the death penalty, but I'm not going to do anything to you. Because we know Moshe didn't tell him anything. Moshe just killed him in practice, right? And so, you know, this text sort of produces this challenge where, on the one hand, the Gemara seems to be defending Moshe's behavior in practice to actually kill the person. But it seems hard to accept that in practice, the penalty for striking someone should be the death penalty. So Rambam says, yeah, we don't do that in practice. But then our original question is back, how could Moshe actually do it in practice? Without directly answering that in the Gemara, we're going to turn to a second rabbinic source that may be related. Gemara wants to know, how did Moshe kill him? So again, our translation before said that Moshe slew him. But if you use the word vayach in the same meaning as Makkah earlier, I picture some sort of striking him, maybe punching him, maybe hitting him with a whatever weapon Moshe might have had on him, maybe an improvised weapon, you know, some blunt object Moshe had. That's how I always envision it. This midrash says no. Or it was a debate. Rabbi Avitar Omer Begrof Harago. Rabbi Avitar says he used an egrof. Actually, there are different opinions about what egrof means here. And for sure later Hebrew, but also in some ancient texts that growth means a fist. There are other texts where it may mean some sort of a tool of some sort. Let's going with a fist might be most comfortable for us. But here he adds, this seems to be one of those texts where, at least in Rabbi Avitar's opinion, when he says agrof, he intends some sort of a tool they would have had during their construction work, right? Something they would have used to scrape or shovel the materials for the bricks. They put, I don't know, a spade or something like that. Now, Banan Amre, he's gear Allah v'shem et Hashem. The other rabbi said, no, Moshe didn't hit him with anything. He said it was a miracle. Moshe said like a secret name of God, and invoking God's name caused him to die. How do we see that? Because the Jew the next day says to Moshe, Hal argeni ata omer, what are you saying to kill me? So this midrash is taking that literally. Are you saying to kill me? Meaning, I know that yesterday you said something to kill the Egyptian. Are you going to say something to me too? Are you going to invoke a divine name on me? Right? From the word ata omer, you see from that word omer, are you saying to kill me, that Moshe apparently said the name of God and that killed him. So we're not going to read it inside, but if you have time, you're going to blow your mind a little bit. On the last page here, is a piece that Rabbi Aaron Soloveitchik wrote where he tries to connect these two things. He says, well, maybe Rambam put these two sources together and said, look, on the one hand, the Chachamim said that Moshe, you know, had a right to kill him because he deserved to die. But Rambam thinks that's not something that a human court would ever do. Maybe what the Gemara means then is the person deserves to die at the hands of God, and combine that with the Midrash that Moshe invoked a divine name in order to kill him. And maybe what we would conclude from that is that Moshe felt, look, this person deserves to die in the heavenly court, so I'll invoke God's name as if to say the heavenly court should punish him. Whether you agree or not with that interpretation, what blew my mind about is the date, Tafresh Pei Zayin, 1927. Rav Aaron Soloveitchik was born in 1917. So whether you think that's the most brilliant way of explaining Rambam ever or not, it's certainly not bad for a 10-year-old, which is how old he was when he wrote it. So again, combining those sources, what I would say about grouping them together is those two sources collectively are assuming somehow what Moshe did was right. God endorsed it, either because God literally heard his name and invoked on the Egyptian and killed him, according to that midrash, or because God believed the law of the Torah is that someone, a non-Jew who strikes a Jew, deserves to die. Somehow God supports Moshe's behavior, but it's hard to see any sort of evidence in the pshat level to see a verdict that the person deserved a formal death penalty or that a divine name was invoked. And so, you know, Ibn Ezra that you see over here, who's more of a pshat-oriented commentator, a commentator who focuses on the simple, plain sense of the text, he says, look, there are those who say, Shizkir Elashim HaMeforash, that Moshe invoked God's name make the person drop dead, but says Ibn Ezra, enenu nachon, that's not correct, in my opinion. I think he used some sort of, maybe a chanit, maybe an evin, maybe a spear, maybe a stone. He used whatever, blunt object or weapon he had nearby. But on the pshat level, it's hard to see a simple reading of the text supporting the idea that Moshe, invoked a divine name to kill him. So that brings us to approach number three, an approach which says that Moshe killing the Egyptian was saving the Hebrew from death, right? So if until now we thought maybe Moshe overreacted because maybe if somebody is losing a fist fight, it's not appropriate to defend them with lethal force against the aggressor because the aggressor wasn't trying to kill anyone. This midrash says, no, actually, this particular Egyptian aggressor was beating this Jew so badly, he was potentially going to kill him. The background to this, which I gave you if you're interested, we're not going to read inside, is this long story that Midrash imagines, where this was not just any old Egyptian taskmaster and any old Hebrew, but it was a case where, not being too specific, this Egyptian taskmaster had somehow gotten involved with the wife of this particular Hebrew, And the Hebrew found out when his wife told him. It seems she was somehow misled into this. So she wasn't really to blame, just the Egyptian was to blame. And as this all blows up, they have this exchange that's much more intense than a typical taskmaster-slave interaction. So much so, the product underlines what I care about for our purposes. So much so, the Egyptian taskmaster is beating and seeking to kill the Jew. That's the key phrase. Right? And so, so the way you might, beat someone to death and just throw them out on the street. And in that moment, Moshe sees this person, and I'm going to leave out some of the details. Moshe picks up on what went on and the fact that, tricking or forcing a woman into an adulterous relationship could itself be one capital offense. And on top of that, right now, the person is threatening the Jew Hebrew's life. So Moshe is like, I can literally think of multiple capital crimes this person is guilty of, including threatening this person's life right now. Amar vadai ze chayav hariga. Says this person, there's no question this person literally deserves to die for what he did, and therefore Moshe kills him. And so this midrash essentially says, look, maybe at face value, we thought that it's not appropriate to just give someone a death sentence for, a quote unquote minor assault. But what this person did went way beyond that. He engaged in he already committed a capital offense of adultery that might not have been fully consensual. Now he's beating this person to the point where he may die. At that point, halacha, we call that rodef, right? If someone is trying to take the life of another person, so it's a textbook self-defense, or in this case, if the Hebrew can't defend himself, so Moshe, on his behalf, is defending his life against an aggressor. And so if you accept the assumption that the Egyptian who was beating him badly enough, the Hebrew's life is in danger, then the conclusion that Moshe was right to kill the Egyptian does, in fact, make a lot of sense. The question would be, returning to the psukim, is it clear in the psukim that this beating, Ish Mitzri, Makei Ish Ivri, that this beating was indeed such a bad beating as to warrant, as to conclude that the Egyptian is what we would call in halacha a rodef, so a pursuer, someone threatening someone else's life? So before I answer that, I want us to see an alternative approach. Sari Gaon. Sari Gaon lived in the 10th century, the 900s, and he translated the Torah into Arabic, Judeo-Arabic, so Arabic written in Hebrew characters. I'll mention, since my mom's sponsoring this year tonight in memory of my aunt, and mentioned, my aunt's name was Aliza, daughter of Moshe, my grandfather. So nice. It's fitting that we're learning about a Moshe, but as well, my grandmother's name, that's sort of hard to pronounce, because just as many Ashkenazi Jews have Yiddish names that someone who didn't know Yiddish might say, oh, that's not a Jewish name, it's a German name, but within the Jewish community, it's a Yiddish name. The same was true of Sephardic Jews. My grandmother was from Morocco, so her quote-unquote Hebrew name was actually the Arabic name, Aisha, which, we had to sort of learn how that was written in Hebrew characters, because in the community she grew up, the Jews would have written their dialect of Arabic in Hebrew characters as they had done for centuries. So in this translation, I highlighted the keywords. You see, three times in blue, you have that root katala. I know that here it's spelled with a tuf in Arabic, and in Hebrew and Aramaic, it's with a tet. Katal. Katal means to kill. So in that whole back and forth where they're saying to Moshe, the Hebrews, are you going to kill me like you killed the Egyptian? Then Paro wanted to kill Moshe. Every time it said laharog in the Hebrew, Sadia translates it with the verb katala, to kill, which is a nice literal translation of harag. Very nice. Every time it said lahakot, makah in Hebrew, he uses the same Arabic root, dad resh bet, daraba, which means to strike or hit in Arabic. Also very nice. But then Sadia does something interesting here. Everyone see over here, he adds, because he adds a word in his translation, it's not in the Torah. He says, Moshe, fadara ba'al mitzri, that's vayachad ha-mitzri, he struck the Egyptian. Famata. Fa is like ve and in Hebrew. and Mata, like mate, and he died. You see it here in Rabbi Kaffa's translation. Moshe struck the Egyptian, and he died. That word's not in the Torah. Why does Tati have to add that word? So if you would have asked me, I would have said, oh, in general, in Tati's translation, it's not 100% literal. He sometimes adds a word here and there for clarification. So he just wants, in case maybe you're reading this and you don't know anything other than Tati's Arabic translation, maybe somehow you don't realize that it was a lethal blow. And because of that, he has to add that word. Even though, I mean, the next words are going to be that Moshe buried him, so obviously it was a lethal blow. But he's just, I would have thought he's just trying to make it a little more clear that it was a lethal blow. Thankfully, it was not up to me to go through this on my own. Rav Yosef Kafik, when he translated this into Hebrew, he also added footnotes. And he also translated a lot of Tzadigal's other writings, when he knew them incredibly well. He says in a footnote, if you really want to know what's going on here, you have to see Saadia's commentary in Mishlei, which is also written in Judeo-Arabic, and Rav Kafik also translated that to Hebrew. So if we look there, in Mishlei it says, Ohev Pesha, Ohev Matzah, one who loves disobedience loves strife. That's a poetic way of saying it's a bad thing to love strife or love conflict. I don't know that you need to write a commentary on that. I think we all understand why it's bad to be somebody who loves conflict. But Saadia decides, in case we don't get it, he's going to explain it to us. The Saadia Gaon says, this is again, Rav Yosef Kafis, Hebrew translation of Saadia's Arabic commentary to Mishlei. What's so bad about conflict? Ki ha-matzah, this is matzah, it's the same word as like matzah that we eat on Passover, but it refers to conflict, strife. Ta'amim, yitzeh mimena mashin harotzer. When you get into a heated conflict, sometimes things come out of it that you didn't want. Sometimes you get so worked up, you do something that going into it you did not intend to do. Maybe afterwards you regret it, but in the heat of the moment, you did it anyway. What's an example of that? Moshe wanted, now lahakot, how do we translate that? We're going to see in a moment, it means to hit. It does not mean to kill, in Saadia's opinion. Moshe wanted to strike the Egyptian for striking a Jew. Right. Moshe wanted, you beating up a Jew, I'm going to give you a black eye, I'll show you. That's what Moshe wanted. V'kahu, so Moshe struck him, v'mit. That is a direct quote, not of the Pasuk, but of Saadia's translation of the Pasuk. Hikahu v'mit. What the Yadrubo famata, or in translation, Hikat Hamitzri v'mit. Moshe struck him and he died. Shekach ne'emar v'yachin Hamitzri. The Pasuk just said v'yachin. All the Saadia is telling you, he added a word in his translation. The Pasuk only said that Moshe struck the Egyptian. Because all he wanted to do was hit him. Hit, in other words, what Saadia is really saying, Moshe wanted to hit him with non-lethal, non-deadly force. And yet, he ended up killing him, right? Because the next day when he's talking to these Shnei Yudim, to these two Jews, these two Hebrews, about how they shouldn't beat each other up, he's telling them, again, right, Lama Tzakeriach, he's telling them that hitting people is bad. And they say, well, hitting people is a bad thing, Moshe? Why? Because, you know, people like you, when you do that, you kill people? It's not a direct quote of what they said to Moshe. That's how Saadia is interpreting it. They're sitting, so talking back to Moshe and saying, like, we're just hitting each other. We're not like you, right? When you hit people, you kill them, but we're not like that. And so Saadia says, what's really good, you know, Moshe is not a bad guy. Moshe isn't someone who thinks that the appropriate response to a fistfight is to kill somebody. He does think the appropriate response, if there's an aggressor and a victim in the fistfight, is to join in and throw a couple of fists at the aggressor to teach him a lesson, maybe to force him to back off. But Moshe intended this would all stay within the realm of non-lethal activities. Happens to be the moral of the story, which is reinforced in the book of Mishlei, the moral of the story is you have to be careful, try not to get into these things, because you may find yourself in a situation where you do things you don't want to do. Even Moshe himself didn't really want to commit murder. Saadia certainly would not call Moshe a cold-blooded murderer. He was someone who meant well, tried to be a good Samaritan, and ended up committing, I don't know, I'm not a lawyer in American law, I don't know if the right term is manslaughter, accidental homicide, whatever the term is, it wasn't cold-blooded murder, But it was a bad outcome that Moshe himself never would have wanted, because he would have known better than to kill someone for that. But he allowed himself to get worked up in the heat of the moment, and that led to an outcome that he wouldn't have wanted. Fascinating thing about this is an earlier source than Sadia that says it, that I didn't put on the source sheet, and that is the Quran. So I don't know exactly what to make of that. Sadia Gaon, again, is an Arabic-speaking Jew living in the Muslim world. Typically, he's what we call a polemicist. He was someone who often would engage in conflicts, and he would attack. Within the Jewish world, he was constantly offering interpretations that were meant to refute Karaite arguments. Outside the Jewish world, you know, was someone who, you know, formulated responses, you know, how to respond to an idea in Christianity or an idea in Islam. He wasn't known primarily as looking to adopt the views of other Jewish groups or other religions. On the contrary, he was known as someone who often would sort of pick a fight. So much so there's one place, I won't get into it now, it's through the laws of Kiddush HaChodesh, the new moon, where Rambam later writes about something Sadia said, but Sadia himself wrote things that he knew were false because he needed to defeat his enemy, which in that case was the Karaites, who had a different perspective on how to declare Rosh Chodesh. And he did it, he was going to do whatever it takes, no holds barred, to defeat the Karaites, even offering interpretations that he knew himself to be incorrect. That's usually Sadia's reputation, is that, and so it strikes me as a bit out of character that he's literally adopting the interpretation from the Quran of this story. But ultimately, it may well be, despite his general tendency to be a polemicist, that in this case, he actually thought this was a great way to understand what Moshe did. It both allows us to feel that from a moral perspective, it's not appropriate to kill somebody just because they're beating someone. But we don't have to judge Moshe as a murderer because Moshe didn't intend to do that. He intended something else. Now, where does this leave us before we see approach number five? What is striking to me about approaches three and four when you compare them is what they do with the word lahakot. They both want, if you go back to the psukim, they both want somehow, you know, I use a buzzword we hear a lot about international law because of armed conflict now, but Rabbi Kalman mentioned that I'm a military chaplain. I don't mean this in the legal sense that militaries use it in war, but that term of proportionality that, you know, we kind of want when somebody responds to an attack, the response should be proportionate. And to be clear, the legal use of that in international law is not actually about numbers or anything like that. You're allowed to use much more force than your enemy. It has to do with proportions of harm to the civilian population versus harm to the military target and the military objectives you're trying to further. But let's use that word in its more sort of simple non-legal meaning. Is Moshe's response sort of an equal and opposite reaction to what the Egyptian did? Or is Moshe doing something above and beyond what the Egyptian did? So notice both approaches three and four see Moshe as responding in kind to the Egyptian, which makes sense in the Psukim because the Egyptian was being makah and Moshe was being makah. Notwithstanding this translation, which has beating and slaying, the Torah uses the same verb the Egyptian did to the Jew, is the same verb Moshe did back to the Egyptian. Where approaches three and four differ is how to translate that verb. Approach number three said the Egyptian was not beating a Hebrew. He was not merely beating. He was attempting to slay a Hebrew, and therefore Moshe slew the Egyptian, and that was the right thing to do. Sadia Gaon is saying the Egyptian was beating a Hebrew, but Moshe didn't mean to slay the Egyptian. All Moshe was trying to do was beat the Egyptian. Happens to be, parenthetically, Sadia in his translation would add a word here. Oh, and by the way, that guy died. Moshe wasn't killing or murdering or attempting to kill. I think the fact that both those interpretations are out there leads us to what ultimately is the best way to interpret this. And this is not my chidush, my innovation. This was suggested by Professor Moshe David Casuto, who was an Italian Jewish Bible scholar in the 20th century, who subsequently made Aliyah and was the head of the Bible department at Hebrew University. Died in the 1950s. And he says over here, look, Moshe kills the Egyptian. And let's look at how the Torah frames it. The Egyptian, the word the Torah used, which however we translate it, the word was hika, struck, slay, whatever. He was a makah, somebody who was striking, whatever that active verb is. He deserves to be a recipient of a similar blow, however you translate it. And note, says Kasuta, at face value, right, following the translation we used earlier, the verb has a slightly different meaning. At first, it's just a beating. Now it's more of a killing. But he says, b'chozot chazarato more al shitat mida kineged mida. Even if we would translate the verb slightly differently, the fact that the Torah chose to use the same verb is to set up what we call mida kineged mida. Measure for measure, the Egyptian got, received exactly what he was dishing out to the Jew. And the way I think is best to think about that, I just want, this is my own two cents, sort of building on what Kasuto said. Not only is he right that the Torah uses the same verb when Moshe responds, but it easily could have said, Moshe killed the Mitzri. I know the Torah knows how to say kill, because the Torah says kill three times in the next couple of psukim, right? When other people characterize what Moshe did, they don't say, you were makeh demitzri. They say, harakta demitzri, lahargeni ata omer. And Paro views it that way. So Paro's idea of midah keneged midah, Paro's idea of a, proportionate response in the non-legal sense is, Moshe, you were a horeg, you were a killer, so I'm going to kill you. I'm going to be horeg you. The Torah very easily, the natural thing to do, if it wanted to say that Moshe somehow did something above and beyond disproportionate to the Egyptian, whether, like the Gemara said, that Moshe did that, but that's okay because the Egyptian deserved it, or to criticize Moshe and say he got too carried away, the Torah so easily could have said, Vayaharoget Hamitzri. And then it would be very clear to us, okay, we have an Egyptian who was makeh a Jew. In a later story, we have a Jew being makeh another Jew. Those are all, fistfights, brawls, beatings. And unlike those things, Moshe actually killed someone with intent to kill. The Torah makes a conscious decision to instead use the same verb for Moshe. I think the best way to think about this is actually something else Sadia mentioned. The idea that this whole incident happened in a moment when Moshe was caught up in emotion. The other parties were probably also caught up in emotion. And the way people carry themselves in the heat of the moment is different when they have the benefit of hindsight. In hindsight, we may be able to look back and say, let's examine, the launch angle of the Egyptian's fist and of Moshe's fist or whatever weapons they had. And maybe we'll conclude upon further investigation of all the forensics that the Egyptian was using a level of force that much force was actually not lethal, would not have been lethal for the Jew. And by contrast, the force that Moshe used apparently was lethal. That might be our conclusion upon further investigation. But in the moment, it seems to me that Torah is trying to say that Moshe did not make a calculation like that. Moshe didn't stand there with, whatever expertise he probably didn't even have, trying to calculate in a mathematical way, is this deadly force or not deadly force? Instead, he responded on instinct. And you have to take in the whole context here. This is Moshe's first time out of the palace. He was grown. He grew up and goes to see what's going on. I should add to that, maybe I should have given you one pasuk earlier. The pasuk right before this, verse 10, pasuk Yud, also says about Moshe, Vayigdal. He grew up. And that repetition seems to be saying he grew up in multiple ways. He physically became an adult, and he matured. This is like Moshe's coming of age story. He's been sheltered in the palace. He steps out of that bubble. He somehow knows he's a Hebrew. It's not clear if that's something that did his mom nurse him long enough? She managed to convey that. Or did his adopted mother, the princess, convey that to him about his background? I mean, she named him Moshe because he was drawn from the water. So she may have told him, I drew you from the water. You're really a Hebrew baby. He somehow knows he's a Hebrew. And so when he sees their suffering, he's not even acting as a human standing up for a human victim. The Torah emphasizes he sees an Egyptian beating a Jew, me'achav, of his brothers. And in case we didn't get the message, right, that's really a repeat, because it had already said Vayitzealachav. This entire trip out of the palace was an opportunity to see what's happening to his brothers. So twice, the Torah emphasizes Moshe, this is a dramatic moment in his life. It's the first time he's actually seeing outside the bubble of the palace what it really means to be a Hebrew versus what it means to be an Egyptian. And the thing he sees is an Egyptian beating a Jew. And yeah, on the pshat level, he doesn't know anything about anyone having an affair or anything like that. He doesn't know about adultery. He doesn't know. And you know, someone in the chat mentioned, you know, maybe I'm sugarcoating too much by saying adultery or using a word like non-consensual. The way the Midrash imagines it, it's something deceptive. So the moment the woman was not, you know, physically coerced, but was somehow misled or duped. And as a military chaplain, we have legal definitions of, you know, when we're doing our job, when we're allowed to use different legal terms for that. But whatever it is, it was something very bad in which the woman was a victim. This man was an aggressor. That's not on the pshat level. On the pshat level, we don't see Moshe knowing that whole history. We see someone who sees this very simple image of an intense beating of a Jew, and he's concerned for the Jew's well-being, and he's upset, and he responds with what he probably sees as, you know, on a superficial level, proportionate force. He's going to deliver, he's going to throw as hard a punch as he knows how to throw. He's probably not thinking lethal, not lethal. And then a minute later, he looks like, whoa, that was enough force to kill the guy. On that point, Saadi may be right. He got a little bit sort of carried away in the heat of the moment. But I think it's a bit much to say he really didn't want to kill him because the Egyptian was doing a crime that didn't deserve that level of penalty. I think this is a heat of moment decision. I see a vicious aggressor, an innocent victim, and I'm going to stand up for the innocent victim in the heat of the moment. And so, you know, maybe the first makah was deadly force. Maybe it wasn't. The Torah wants to keep it vague, just as maybe Moshe saw himself using deadly force. Maybe he didn't. Most likely he wasn't even thinking about deadly versus non-deadly force. He was just thinking, I better hit this guy really hard because that's the way I'm going to rescue this Jew. Right? And the next day, it sinks into everyone that what happened was a killing. Here, I think Kasuto has a second insight to further, you could argue that maybe the Torah is saying Moshe didn't fully think it through, and maybe that's a bad thing. But it seems to me the Torah is trying to say that was actually to Moshe's credit. This Kasuto over here, in this act, Moshe showed Tuchunot Rucho, the characteristics of his spirit. Who is Moshe at his core? Ruach shel ish rodif tzedek. He's somebody who pursues justice. M'maher lahoshia ashukim yarosh kehem. He hastens. He's in to save victims from their oppressors. Ruach shel she'ifa l'chirut shel gvralit mokim neged aritzim. The spirit of, you know, striving for freedom. Maybe that's a bit of an overstatement. Boldness against tyrants. And someone, that's their gut instinct. The gut instinct is to not overthink this and to stick up for the victim. That's exactly the person whom God wants to be their leader. If Moshe overthought things and stood there, you know, calculating exactly what level of force is appropriate or not appropriate to use, and while he was calculating it, the Jew is getting beaten up worse and worse, that might actually mean he was not a good fit for the job of leading Am Yisrael. It's specifically the fact that Moshe gets so worked up that he delivers this devastating blow in the heat of the moment that makes him the type of person that you want to lead B'nai Israel. I want to add one point to that, since Kasuda wrote a lot of the language in a way that could have been true, even if this were not an Egyptian and a Hebrew, right? Moshe is a champion of victims of injustice. I want us to look at the story a little more carefully and notice that it's both true and not true. Overall in this narrative, is Moshe a pursuer of justice and a defender of victims of injustice no matter their identity? The final answer is yes, because of what happens at the end here. Moshe runs away to the well in Midian. when he gets to this well in Midian, I didn't give the whole story here. I think it's a fairly well-known story. He finds Yitro's daughters at the well being bullied or intimidated by the other shepherds, and he defends them. And he has no ethnic, nationalistic, religious stake in that, right? It's Midianite women being bullied by Midianite men, and he's not a Midianite, right? He's a Hebrew, an Egyptian, some of each. And so it certainly is true. Moshe is someone who stands up for victims of injustice. But the Torah also wants to make it very clear, as I said before, twice in that pasuk, the Torah uses this word echav, his brothers. When Moshe stands up for the Jew, the Hebrew, it's not just that there's a slave who's a victim and a taskmaster and an oppressor who's the oppressor and the aggressor. It is that Moshe feels a certain kinship for this person. And what God really wants out of Moshe is both those things, that he feels a kinship for Bnei Israel, and he's bothered by the injustice that's going on. And the fact that the Torah portrays him as someone who gives this midah keneged midah, this tit for tat, this proportionate response, again, not in the military legal sense, but in the sense that we often use it colloquially. He hits back with an equal and opposite reaction to what the Egyptian did, whether those were intended to be lethal or non-lethal blows. The fact that that's his gut reaction when Hebrew is being beaten is part of why he's the right leader to choose. I'll say one more thing, since I think we do have time. Rabbi Ovadia Sforno, a commentator from the 1400s in Italy, when he looks at these three stories together, that are, or we said the three parts of one story, Moshe killing the Egyptian, Moshe trying to break up a fight between two Hebrews the next day, and then Moshe defending Yitro's daughters by the well, he says collectively they're meant to teach how Moshe always intervenes. He's never a passive bystander, but you see the exact way it depends on whether one, both, or neither party is a Hebrew. And that's kind of the point. I'll start from the end. In Midian at the well, nobody's a Hebrew. Moshe intervenes. He doesn't kill anyone there. He somehow stands up and says something. It's not even clear. The text just says he rescued them. It doesn't say exactly what he did. He sends some sort of a message to the other shepherds that he's not going to tolerate bullying. It doesn't sound like he ever came close to taking a life. When he sees two Hebrews fighting, we can't fathom if he just is internalizing how they're his brothers, he's going to kill the aggressor. And he does it. He talks to them and tries to be a chaplain at the moment, talk them through their conflict, right? The combination of the fact that there was a grave injustice in the opening narrative and that the aggressor was an Egyptian and the victim was a Jew, and Moshe is sort of coming into his Hebrew identity here, is that combination that makes him so worked up he delivers a deadly blow. And again, the point of all that, I think, is by design. That's exactly what God wants to see here, that Moshe has that level of passion to defend them. And here, you know, there will be time for a couple of minutes of questions when I'm done. I want to close my presentation with a midrash that I think says this in such a beautiful way. There are different versions of the midrash. Here's a midrash Tanchuma. There are different versions of this midrash that says there are three things that don't really belong to Moshe, but are attributed or ascribed to him. One is the Torah. God gave us the Torah. And yet, we often call it Torah Moshe. Says the Midrash, why? Natan nafsho al Torah. Moshe practically gave his life for the Torah, right? He goes up to Har Sinai for 40 days and nights. He could have starved to death. God took care of him, so he didn't starve to death. The fact that he's prepared to go 40 days and nights without eating, but he can only live by the grace of God, that level of sacrifice for the Torah earns him the right, it earns him the naming rights. That's why we call it Torah Moshe. So too, in this version of the Midrash, Moshe has judges named after him. How so? So in this version of the Midrash, and we'll skip to the end, it talks about how he did the righteous tzedakah Hashem asa mishpatav in Israel. Moshe did like the righteousness of God, and his mishpatim His laws are with Israel. Whose laws? It's an ambiguous pronoun. It could be read as Moshe's laws. The Torah's laws are Moshe's laws. The justice system is Moshe's justice system. Other Midrashim quote the Pasuk where Moshe is commanded to, he actually commands the Bnei Yisrael to appoint judges. Shoftim v'shoftim titen lecha b'chol sha'aracha, appoint judges for you. The simple pshat there is the you is Bnei Yisrael. Some versions of this Midrash read that you as Moshe, that they're going to appoint judges, but Moshe gets the credit for the justice system. But whatever the proof text is, the idea is somehow the justice system, the judges are Moshe's judges, Moshe's justice system. Why? At the beginning of this Midrash, I mentioned that Pasuk I alluded to, Titen Lecha. Right? The Dayanim, judges, are named after Moshe. Why? Because Moshe gave his life for justice. Where did Moshe give his life for justice? He gave his life for justice. He could have been killed. Paro wanted to kill him, but he stood up to this Egyptian victim, to this Egyptian Jewish victim of the Egyptian aggressor. And there's a quote to this whole story. Also, the second time, right? He intervenes a second time as well. Right? This Midrash seems to take both those things. The fact that he stood up to the Jewish victim and tried to break up a fight between two Jews the next day. All those things show how he was willing to put his neck on the line for justice. And that's why Dayanim are Moshe's Dayanim. He earned it with that risk. Now, the third thing that it says he's credited for, I didn't give you this part of the Midrash here. Some Midrashim quote different psukim for this, is Bnei Israel. When God tells Moshe, I want to destroy them at the golden calf, he says, Moshe, you better go down and see what's going on with that calf. Your nation is in big trouble. Your nation did some really bad stuff. So, this Midrash appears in five or six different places. Certain of the Midrashim say, wait a minute. Your nation, right? So you have the two parents, one parent says to the other, go see what your kid is doing. And then, like, my kid, your kid too. Right? Midrash says, Moshe could say back to God, like, my nation? They're your chosen nation, not my chosen nation. What are you telling me, your nation? But says the Midrash, God sort of knows how that story is going to play out. Ultimately, Moshe puts his neck on the line for them with the golden calf, right? He says, God, if you want to destroy them, erase me from your book. Rashi takes that to mean erase me from the Torah. Most unfortunately take it to mean a metaphor, erase me from the book of life. If you want to kill them, kill me with them. I'm their leader. Moshe risked his life for Bnei Israel in that moment, so they're his nation. Some variations of that Midrash, when they talk about Moshe giving his life for Bnei Israel, they quote the Pasuk that in our Midrash is quoted as Moshe gave his life for the justice, right? He struck the Egyptian. He was risking his life on behalf of a Jew. That's why we're Moshe's nation. So to sum up, I think what Kasuto says about that ambiguity in the word Lahakot, the Torah trying to say Moshe was delivering an appropriate response. The Egyptian was a makah, a striker, a hitter, a slayer, however you want to translate that. Whatever it was, that's what Moshe was doing back to him. The Psukim are saying that in the context of a bunch of stories that are praising Moshe, someone who has the trait of sticking up for the victim with an added level of zeal when the victim was one of his people. And that's what this Midrash is saying in the various versions of it, that Moshe gave his risked his life both over the injustice of what was going on, and according to some versions, over the fact that it was one of his people. And the fact that he's willing to stick up for them in that way is why they are called Moshe's people, and why our justice system is Moshe's justice system. We have about a minute left. I'm just going to check if there's anything in the chat that I need to address. It's a fair point. Someone says, you know, he may be okay with striking the Egyptian. It turns out striking the rock inappropriately ends up being his downfall. That's an excellent point. Again, I already addressed the comment that, I'm not using particular terms like rape or sexual assault to describe what the Midrash says about Moshe's wife, because each of those things is a legal term with certain laws. But clearly, the Midrash understands the wife to be a victim. And one more comment in the chat, which I think is a fair point. There are ways you can read the text that Moshe had some awareness that what he was doing was unjustified. He did look around to make sure there were no witnesses, but as well, he may be looking around to make sure there are no witnesses because for sure what he did is illegal under Egyptian law. It doesn't necessarily court Egyptian law at the time that a taskmaster could beat a Jewish slave doesn't necessarily correspond to Moshe's morals. And thank you everyone for joining. As my mom mentioned at the beginning, this is in memory of my aunt, and I will say one thing about her to conclude. She was a lawyer who became a mediator, and I think in a certain sense it's fitting that ending of Moshe sacrificed himself and put himself out there to stand up for injustice in different ways. At first he was aggressive the first time around, but then between two Jews he becomes a mediator. I think I hope is an appropriate tribute to my aunt, who again began her career as a lawyer, and then her true calling, she became a very accomplished mediator using those same legal talents to try to actually bring peace between people through conversation. Thank you very much. Shabbat Shalom.
Thank you very much. Yasher Koach. Thank you. Okay, if anybody has a quick question orally, they want to ask if you have half a minute. I don't know if anybody does. But
no, I'm happy to stay on if people have questions.
Yeah. I have a question. Using the same methodology I think the Ibn Ezra did to justify what Moses did, could you apply the same thing to what Cain did? Didn't know what he was doing. In other words, there seems to me to be a parallel from the Ibn Ezra analysis of Moses hitting and in the heat of the moment and what his punishment was from God versus what Cain got.
That's a great question. I don't want to get sort of beyond the scope to go into that story in depth, but I will say two things about that. One, I agree with you that sometimes the cover up is worse than the crime. Had Cain's response to God when God asked, "Where is Hevel your brother?" had his response been, "I'm devastated. We got into a bit of an argument. I had no idea that there's a thing called death and that however he struck him." Which is not clear there also exactly how the killing went down. You have a similar ambiguity in the language there. But if Cain had tried to say, "Look, I didn't know the strength of my own blow. I didn't quite understand what was going on. I feel terrible." One gets the sense God would have responded differently than Cain saying, "I don't know where he is. Am I my brother's keeper?" And I'll say as well, there are different approaches in the Mefarshim there as far as how premeditated it was, right? There's this weird phraseology in the text there. It says, Cain said to Hevel, and then when they were in the field, Cain rose up and killed him. But it doesn't say what Cain said. And Rashi there mentions there are certain midrashim that imagine they were debating some topic and it escalated. They were arguing about one midrash, who's going to marry a certain female. The midrash assumes they had sisters because who are they going to marry? And they got into a fight over that. And they got into a fight over where the Beit HaMikdash was going to be built, whose territory. Rav Amital, Rosh Yeshiva Gersh, had this beautiful sikha where he said, in essence, the Midrash covers all the things that are the major causes of violence throughout history, fights over religion, fights over sort of love triangles gone awry, and so forth. And so that Midrash imagines a fight that escalated and got out of control. Rashi himself says, I know the Midrash said all that, but I think the pshat is that the Torah didn't tell us what Cain said, because it was trivial. The words didn't matter, but Rashi actually used the word matzah that we had over here, divrei rivu matzah, that he kind of was picking a fight. He said something trivial. He said, your sweater is ugly. Just so Hevel would say, why is my sweater ugly? That's not nice. And it would escalate. And he wanted to say something that would trigger an escalation that would give him the opportunity to have the altercation turn physical so that he could kill him. So again, depending on your perspective there, if you think Cain had some sort of a plan to make it escalate, and then he wants to cover it up, he looks pretty horrible. If you think it escalated naturally, then really, if not for the cover-up, he may not look so bad.
Thank you. That midrash, Nechama Leibowitz, I heard you mentioned Nechama earlier, so that was the first one, the first thing she taught us. And the third thing they were fighting about is whose land it is, right? Islam, my land, your land. So those are the three areas that we fight over: property, assets, oil, whatever you want to say, over religion, and over woman. That's right, but thank you very much. Yes, very good. All right, I think We'll say thank you very much, Yasher Koach, and very nice to have Miss Fraser, Rachel Fraser, with us, the mother, to get lots of Nach has been smiling for the last hour at least. So thank you very much, and should good memories from your aunt, and we should all be blessed with Simchat. Tomorrow morning, of course, my shiur on the Siddur at 9:15, Villa Malshinim. We'll finish that up. Hopefully, that brach on the Shmon Esrei move to Al HaTzadikim, and then on Sunday, Rabbi Liebtag. There are no new series beginning next week. In a couple of weeks, we'll have, I think, I don't know, 10 classes, whatever we have exactly next week. So we look forward to learning with you. Look forward to the year now. They did sign the peace ceasefire. I don't know, back and forth. Let's hear good news from Israel, please God. And all the hostages should come home, or whoever's alive should come home soon. It's a terrible situation, as we all know, and we should hear good news and good things, and wish everybody a Shabbat Shalom. And okay, we look forward to learning with you, and please don't forget to invite a friend. That's what I tell you all the time, but not enough people tell me. You have to write me which friend you invited, so then I won't have to tell you anymore, you know. But so yeah, that's our best form of advertising. And everybody be well. Laila Tov. Thank you.
Laila Tov, and thank you.
And thank you, Rav Ezra. Okay, thank you.